Welcome to Science Studio.
Well, it's great to be on the programme, Keith.
Lovely. And before we get into the big questions, the ones that you've sort of been posing for the last 20 years almost, at least for the general public, mm-hmm. you were once a little boy. You were little Martin one time, 5 years old, 10, 15. How did the transformation come? What was it that set you on your path?
Well, it was a chapter of accidents, really. I had a very happy upbringing in the country, in Shropshire, which is a county on the west of England. And
It's almost Wales.
That's right, yes. And so just 1 mile the side of the border. And I was interested in nature and in numbers in a specific way. And I went to school. And in the English system, we have this, I think, deplorable early specialisation, where when you're 15, you have to decide which subject you want to specialise in.
Before and that, you have this famous 11-plus examination.
Yes, well,
This is actually more odious, as far as I'm concerned.
That's right, yes. And so the system, at least that's been abolished.
Yes.
But the specialisation at age 15 or 16 has not been abolished. And I opted for science, frankly, because I was bad at languages. It wasn't a very positive thing. I turned out to be good at mathematics. And so I got into Cambridge to study mathematics. And in retrospect, that was a mistake, because I knew when I was an undergraduate here that I didn't have the mindset of the people who were going to be mathematicians, who were among my classmates. I knew I preferred a more sort of synthetic or synoptic style of thinking. And so my undergraduate years weren't very happy academically for that reason. And
were they socially delightful?
They were socially okay, yes. But I had some friends, two of whom switched to economics and in fact became rather well-known economists, and they're still friends. And I thought perhaps of going that way, and I think I would have enjoyed being an economist. But by a chain of accidents, I ended up being accepted as a graduate student in Cambridge to study astrophysics and cosmology. This was in the Department of Applied Mathematics, it was called. But I was very lucky in two respects. The first respect was that I was in a group that was led by someone called Dennis Sharma, who was a very inspiring professor, and he had a very strong group of students with him. It was good to be in that group. So that was one piece of luck. And the other was that this was the mid-1960s, 1965, and this was an exciting time in astronomy, when for the first time we had evidence of the Big Bang, we had evidence for black holes coming up and neutron stars, and the ability to probe the distant universe. So it was a great time to be going into the subject, because a piece of advice which I always give to young people going into science is go into something where new things are happening, new observations or new techniques or new instruments, because then you can do things the old guys never had a chance to do.
That's an important point where you mentioned...
Otherwise, you find yourself doing the problems they got stuck on. unless you're brighter than them, you won't make any progress. So I was lucky in being in a good environment at a good time for the subject.
The whole business of instrumentation, you mentioned it, and that is so key to... In chemistry, for example, every time that the physicists come up with a new instrument, because it's usually the physicists that go the basic science,
and
all of a sudden we've got a whole new lease on life.
Well, absolutely, for crystallography and everything like that. Yes.
Absolutely.
And of course in astronomy even more so. And the development of radio astronomy, of course, after World War II was crucial, and bigger telescopes. And of course the big change was actually going from photographic plates to solid-state detectors, because that meant that any telescope became about sort of 80 times more powerful.
That's absolutely correct.
To 80% efficiency.
So what was your research on, your doctoral research?
Well, my research was theoretical, but I would say phenomenology, in that I was trying to make sense of some of these new observations. And as I said, the style of thinking I liked was trying to make sense of a set of disparate observations, rather like, I suppose, an engineer who's trying to make something work from a given set of components to meet certain specifications. And so I was trying to sort of think of a model that would explain the early observations of quasars, which are rather mysterious objects, and also to try and understand something about how galaxies emerged and formed.
So if I was to sort of jump to today and say I'd like to sort of explain to my grandchildren what the current simple ideas are about the nature of our universe, right? The ones where most people are in agreement, people like yourself, who study this. And then we'll get on to the more speculative thing. Where are we in this idea now of our universe? There's the Big Bang. This is universally presumably accepted by all.
Yes, I mean, I think before I mention that, let's mention that the most exciting thing has been the realization of how many kinds of objects are in the cosmic zoo, as it were, and the most recent discoveries have been planets around other stars and things like that.
So exoplanets.
That's right. And also the ability to get direct, fairly firm evidence about what happened in the past by looking at things a long way away whose light set out a long time ago. But as regards the Big Bang, when I was starting, there was no clear evidence that it ever happened, because there was a theory called the steady state theory, which was plugged by my predecessor as professor in Cambridge, Fred Hoyle, according to which the universe had existed from everlasting to everlasting and had not changed. And that was a tenable view until the mid-1960s, when it became possible to find evidence from remote places and therefore remote times in the past that things were different then. Things weren't in a steady state. And so from an era in the mid-1960s when the Big Bang itself was controversial, we've now got to a stage when we can talk with great confidence about what the universe was like back to a time a nanosecond after the Big Bang, and how it evolved from this very hot, dense state and expanded. And that hot, dense state was 13.8 billion years ago. We know that with about 1% precision. And we can say what happened after that, how after about 300,000 years it cooled down enough that all the primordial gas became neutral and transparent. And after about 100 or 200 million years, the first stars formed, and then galaxies, etc.
So this is...
We have this cosmic history and outline, which I would say is as firmly established as anything a geologist would tell you about the history of the Earth. So this is immense progress. But of course, this opens up new questions, and of course, the questions we are now posing couldn't even have been posed 40 years ago. And let me just say why I said a nanosecond. The special thing about a nanosecond is that that's the time when all the particles in the universe have thermal motions which give them an energy as high as you can get in a big particle accelerator. So we can't go back to an earlier time, because then every particle has more energy than we can simulate in the biggest experiment on Earth. So
we don't have any firm foothold in experiments
for the first nanosecond.
I remember when the Big Bang was sort of being discussed, because I'm old enough to have been there too. Mm-hmm. And I remember there were other people that were thinking of the universe as sort of an oscillatory process. Mm-hmm. That yes, indeed, there could have been a Big Bang, everything will sort of fly apart, but then it will slowly, you know, finish its trajectory, if you like, and then gravitational force, bring it all back together. Mm-hmm. That is completely now dismissed as a possibility?
Well, in a sense, that could exist, because when we think about what might have happened in the first tiny, tiny fraction of a second, we have some ideas. There's an idea called cosmic inflation, that it expanded exponentially from microscopic size, and some versions of that suggest that our Big Bang could be one of many. So there are lots of ideas which are not too different from the idea of a cyclic universe. But there's one other thing that we have learnt, which is that the most plausible long-range forecast is that the universe will go on expanding forever rather than stop expanding and re-collapse back to a so-called big crunch. And this is something which has become clear in the last 20 years, because we can observe the expansion rate now, and we can observe the expansion rate in the past by looking at distant galaxies, and it seems that it's speeding up.
But I mean, you could argue it's like sort of exponential growth of bacteria, right? They grow, there's time when they're really, and then So it may be we're just in that exponential growth of the universe, is that?
Well, it looks as though the acceleration of the galaxies will continue. We don't know, of course, because it's being driven by some mysterious force in empty space we don't understand. But the simplest model of the universe suggests that for at least the last half of its lifetime, this expansion has been speeding up. And the natural extrapolation of that is that the distant galaxies we see will not only get further and further away, but they will accelerate away, so their redshift gets bigger, and they eventually disappear over the horizon.
I was going to say, because...
Rather like something that falls into a black hole. And so if you were to come back in 100 billion years, nothing. You'd find a very dark and empty universe when
right.
everything except our local set of galaxies, us and Andromeda,
right.
would have disappeared over the horizon.
That's quite a terrifying thought, of course, yeah. right from the human point of view. I think somewhere in your latest book you put that the only universality on Earth is the night sky.
That's right. right? That's
and
right.
and of course that combines people from all around the world to have
that's
a commonality.
Right. Well, that's a good feature about astronomy.
Absolutely, but get rid of that, and boy, it's, where
well,
do
of
you
course,
begin?
Our galaxy would not be disrupted, but all the stars would die, because the other thing we know is that stars go through a life cycle, and they use up their energy. The bigger stars burn their energy more prolifically and have shorter lifetimes and are brighter, whereas even the fainter stars would eventually die out.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here in Cambridge with Professor Martin Rees of Trinity College. We're discussing his studies and his interest in the future, the past. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Martin Rees in Trinity College, Cambridge. And yes, this is, you mentioned something just now, I'm passing through, but this other concept, which seems really quite, I don't know, terrifyingly simple, plausible, and yet implausible. Multiple universes, multiple Big Bangs. This intrigues me no end in your book.
Mm-hmm.
This, we'll come on to the book later. Tell us a little bit about where people think this might go and why.
Well, a health warning first. This is speculation.
Yeah, yes.
As I said, we have confidence in extrapolating back cosmic history to a time when everything that we can now observe with our telescopes was squeezed to this very high density and emerged from a Big Bang whose properties we can understand a bit. But of course, there's no reason to think that that's the entirety of physical reality. And there are some ideas which suggest that beyond our observational horizon, there are hugely more galaxies than we can see. And even that the aftermath of our Big Bang is not the entirety of physical reality, and that there may be other Big Bangs.
So this is an idea. But
it's an idea, yes, and it's something which is speculation, and I think will only be firmed up when, if ever, we have a theory which allows us to describe the physics at these very, very extreme conditions when the entire universe is compressed to microscopic size. And if we had a theory which could account for the physics of that time and which we could corroborate by observations we can make, so we gain confidence in it, then we would take seriously other predictions, because as a methodological point about science, it's not true you have to be able to verify all its predictions. You have to verify enough predictions to have confidence in it, and then you take seriously what it predicts in context you can't observe. To take an example, Einstein's relativity theory. We believe, because we can test it in many contexts, and we therefore believe what it says about the inside of black holes, where we can't observe. So we may one day have a theory which applies to the early Big Bang and which could be tested in many ways. And if it predicts multiple Big Bangs, we take that prediction seriously. But it's still a speculation at the moment.
But there are a lot of people sort of thinking about this now. I mean, whereas 20 years ago it would be comic book material.
Yes,
but
yes,
now
yes.
There are serious people around the world.
Yes, I mean, not very many, but it's a serious consequence because, of course, this links together with the study of the microworld and efforts to unify gravity with the force of the microworld, which has been a long-standing quest in physics. And a lot of people work on ideas like string theory, which will do this. And clearly, these will involve studying both the microworld and studying the cosmos.
You bring up the idea of producing a theory that allows you to make predictions that you can sort of think are pretty reliable. This is really in the realm, as you point out, string theory. It's higher mathematics. I mean, this is the thing that drives, I think, so much of the modern understanding and the expectation of further understanding. And the problem with mathematics is the fact that it's going back to like 400, 500, 600 years when the priests were in control of knowing, you know, how to interpret all sorts of phenomena, interpret the holy books, the holy scriptures. Mm-hmm. Now we're in the same position that there's just this small coterie of people who understand in some profundity the higher math, and the rest of us just have to sort of take for granted. That's a little worrying.
Well, and this is a special problem for things like string theory, where the math is very complicated and challenging mathematics. But of course, it hasn't generally been like that, because, in a sense, Newton, and we're sitting within 100 yards away, did all his work, of course. He developed some new mathematical ideas himself. But if we look at most of the big breakthroughs in physics, they've used maths off the shelf. Einstein used mathematics already there, and the pioneers of quantum theory also used maths at least 100 years old. And so in general, the math has been there first before it's been applied. But you're right in saying that some of these ideas being explored now by some mathematical physicists are a challenge to mathematicians themselves. And of course, this raises a deeper question. Will these ideas be too deep for the human mind? Because one point which I make in my book is there's no particular reason to think that the capacities of the human brain are matched to understanding all aspects of reality. Indeed, it's rather remarkable in a way that we've got so far as we have, because our brains haven't changed very much in the last 50,000 years, and they evolved to cope with the everyday world, the common sense world, and it's amazing that they've been able to make so much progress in understanding the numerical world of the quantum and the world of the cosmos. So it could be that they will hit the buffers, and of course that raises another question about whether machines will be able to aid us.
We'll come to that a little later, because that's looking into the future.
Sure, that's right. Yeah.
Before we leave this business of the universe and the what's out there, night sky, we read so much and listen quite often to people talking about the fact that, well, if we take all of the mass that's out there, it's a small part of what we theoretically say is out there. So we get issues like dark matter, dark energy. Put it into the simplest terms, if you wouldn't mind, Martin, to explain, because we've done many programs talking about this, but never with someone at your level of grasp. Yes. Discuss and tell us a little bit what these two terms really mean for you.
Well, I mean, it's fairly clear now from observations that the gravitational pull that holds galaxies together can't be provided just by the stars and gases you see, and that there must be about 5 or 6 times as much stuff in a form which is not visible. And most people think that this is some swarm of particles which have no electric charge and don't interact with each other much, and they just move around and they provide the dominant gravitational
field. And this is speculation too.
Well, but it's very firmly based speculation. I mean, what these particles are is not known, but the evidence that this matter exists is extremely compelling. It's in a sense rather like if you are looking at a star and it's going around in a circle and you can't see what is going around. You infer there's some black hole or something that is orbiting around. And in the same way, if we look at the way stars are moving in the galaxy, then we infer there is this extra material. And I think that's compelling. And we could do a lot more than that. We can do
extra mass is what you're
mass,
really saying.
Yes,
right.
Yes. And we can do modelling of how galaxies behave and what their shapes are, and more importantly, how they form, and how we get from the amorphous Big Bang to the present universe. And we have a extremely successful theory which is based on assuming that this dark matter behaves like a swarm of non-interacting particles and is about 6 times as massive collectively
as everything that we see.
But there's no reason to be surprised about this. I mean, not everything on the earth shines, so why should everything in the universe shine? So there are all too many candidates for it. So I don't think this is something which should be regarded as something intrinsically implausible.
But at some stage, one has to assume that the scientific community will be able to get experimental evidence for this new material.
Yes, it might be very hard.
Yes.
Because one thing we do know is that it's not any particle which has yet been created in an accelerator. But what we also know is that if you think of the range of masses which particles could have, consistent with general ideas of physics, there's 12 powers of 10 between the highest energy we can get in an accelerator and the highest mass these things could have. So this is a huge unexplored space. It'll be very, very hard to detect. But having said that, obviously, it would be nice to know what this stuff is. People are doing experiments in accelerators. They're also looking for evidence for these particles, because even though they don't interact much, they occasionally interact and underground experiments to look for them. And also, there's a possibility that they occasionally interact with each other and annihilate out in space. And so people are looking for evidence of gamma rays from space. So there are these three lines of attack. But my view is that it may well turn out that no experiment feasible in the next 50 years will ever be able to detect what they are. But that won't diminish my belief.
Enthusiasm, right.
Because there's so much parameter space that we can't explore.
So that comes to a sort of a secondary point. I was going to bring it later, but I'll do it now because it's appropriate. How difficult is it for you? You're in government. I mean, I've got to say that. You are a sitting member of the House of Lords, and when you say something, people pay attention, I hope, anyway. How difficult is it to persuade governments these days to fund the type of research that is needed to continue that quest? Because it's a very esoteric quest. From you think of all the diseases we've got, all the economic issues, transmigrations, so many issues.
Well, I mean, I'll say two things. First, obviously, these big experiments involve international partnerships. And although the expenditure on, say, the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, huge instrument, looks vast, in fact, it takes about 2% of this country's science budget and 2% of the science budget of others. And I think most people would say that to spend 2% of a science budget on understanding the bedrock nature of particles
is
appropriate. It's just that that amount is spent in one conspicuous thing by nations banding together and spending 20 years' worth of their funding on this one big thing, whereas in, say, chemistry, they're spending it on thousands and thousands of much smaller things. So I think that's a reason why one shouldn't be too apologetic about spending 2% on these big accelerators.
They were going to dig a very big hole in Texas for a collider some time ago, and then that sort of...
Well, of course, that was going to be a bigger experiment than the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, and would have perhaps been something which would have preempted it. But I think, if I can be impolite to the Americans, they handled things very badly. First, they didn't build it alongside the existing Fermi lab. They started digging holes in Texas, as you know, they didn't even get the support of the scientific community in America. Some of the great physicists in America opposed it, and so that was obviously not a very effective political start. And also, when they tried to get international partnerships, they went to the Japanese and asked for $900 million without having really collaborated with them at all. So they behaved in a rather arrogant and ineffective way. So I'm not surprised that project failed. But then I'm very glad that the Americans participated in the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, which of course was a European project, but it has partnerships all around the world and has been a great success. And of course, when the next accelerator will be built, we just don't know. It may happen in China or Japan, we don't know. But I think to just talk about astronomy, which is a slightly different case from particle physics, in astronomy there's really not just one big instrument. There's a whole range of experiments that have been done to probe everything from planets around other stars to the distant parts of the universe. And this involves telescopes on the ground and in space. And this has the value that we can also explain to the public more easily what we're doing.
Which is an important role that scientists are very loath to actually get involved in. I just
contest that. I think many of them enjoy doing it.
Well, let's just, before we finish this segment, let me just go back to, okay, you explained your understanding and therefore my understanding of dark matter. Dark energy.
Yes.
This presumably is something associated with this increasing expansion of the universe. It's got to come from somewhere.
That's right. This is more mysterious. The discovery of the accelerating universe implies that there is a sort of repulsive force pushing the universe apart, which we can't detect locally, even within the galaxy. But it overwhelms the effect of gravity if you average over the immensely dilute intergalactic space. And this means that even empty space exerts a force. And this seems to be the case, but we don't understand the details. And in my view, we won't understand this until we have a theory which unifies the microworld and the cosmos, because I think everyone believes that empty space itself has a structure, but whereas ordinary materials have a structure on the scale of atoms, they think that the scale on which empty space has a structure is a trillion trillion times smaller than atoms, and therefore very hard to observe. But string theory, for instance, postulates that if you were to chop up space on its very, very tiny scale, you'd find that what we think of as a point in our space is in fact a wrapped up origami in five or six extra dimensions.
Wow.
And so we have to understand that, in my view, before we really understand why empty space exerts this rather weak push on the cosmic scale.
A lot of things that we don't understand. But right. Martin Rees, I'd just like to thank you very much for this segment of our discussion, our conversation. And thank you very much. And I'd like to thank Dennis Wu for producing the program so it sounds as good as it does. And we'd like to thank you, the listener, for being here. And we'll be back next week with yet another Science Studio.